Number 24B.
So we can see that there is an impersonal shaker at work, the cybernetic, the processor, who processes always these ideas, and actually we will feel that Christ shaker the more as we have gone through the Christ order, because there we have acquainted ourselves intimately with the power of the Christ that can descend really from the divine principle to the point of every idea, to every idea, to every individual idea. It is that power that can translate itself to every situation, to every calculus. So here, at the point of science, as the Christ, that Christ appears as that impersonal, no calculator, divine calculator, that knows how to calculate and transform it to our thought. So again we'll see in science, compared with metaphysics, we have to let the divine principle of being use the identities of being in the way the Christ wants to use them, in the way that the Christ wants to combine them and bring out a new form. So it becomes more and more subjective. Again, we can ask ourselves here, why is this the divinely objective subjective standpoint? Now, the divinely objective is naturally that spirit sense, that reflection sense, that objectively the possibility of infinite combination is possible. That's the divinely objective sense. And the divinely subjective sense is truth, because it is according to truth's own consciousness that these relationships are being formed. Not we form them, not we say what kind of form should come out, so we don't know yet the objectification of it. So that you have their spirit again, the divinely objective, and truth as the divinely subjective. Then we come to the next box, mind and love. What did we feel that mind and love would tell us here?
Each idea has its place in the divine plan.
That each idea has its place within the divine plan. That's, I think, accurate, very accurate, that each idea, now, what is this idea? So to say, that which the calculus has brought forth as a new form, this is now the new idea, or the new demonstration, or the new effect, and that as a new idea, mind, has its right place, its perfect place in a whole plan. One also hears that this would mean that each idea has its own perfection, mind and love. But there we have to be careful, because that's just the point here that we must know what is meant by its own perfection. We have seen yesterday that something can be perfect for an individual situation, but not perfect for a universal concept. That something, just take that illustration we have taken yesterday, that a new chemical product may be a very perfect product, may serve an enormous lot of good for the individual, but the spin-off of that production is so bad that universally, ecologically, we really should say, no, one shouldn't produce it. So it is with an individual demonstration. Sometimes we feel in an individual situation which needs to be solved right away, that if we can solve it right away in a way that it satisfies us, that we say that was a perfect demonstration, not knowing, not asking if this perfect demonstration is actually perfect, if it's actually so that it is for the good of all, that it really blesses all, that it really also blesses us in the long run and not in the short run. that if in the whole plan of our life it is actually a contribution that is perfect or not. So we see that in practice very often, that naturally one tries to attain, that the patient tries to attain a solution, an immediate solution that is just right for the moment, not asking what are the consequences in the long run. And so here we must be clear that an idea must not just be perfect, so to say, for the individual situation in a limited sense, but it must be perfect within the whole plan of God, say in the whole plan of the individual or in the whole plan of the universe, so that we are a world factor and not just trying to demonstrate our own well-being. We must really see that we become a world factor, that we have, that we are a perfect contribution for the whole world. And this is naturally a much bigger demonstration than just to get an answer for an individual question for the moment. Yes. Again, we ask here, what is divinely objective, what is divinely subjective? Again, mind would be the divinely objective, namely, the demonstration we have made is very objective. It's a demonstration, mind. It's an idea that has shown itself and has objectified itself divinely. That's that. But we do not know if it is the right thing within the whole. Only the divinely subjective sense knows if it is placed within the whole at the right point and fulfills there its right function. So always the first of those two synonymous terms indicate really the objective approach, and the second one the subjective standpoint. So it's a divinely subjective here love that says, I can fathom, love can fathom if a demonstration is right or not right. Objectively, we can't. Objectively, we can't. We just see, well, something has happened, something has changed. It seems to us good, but that it seems to us humanly. But we do not know if it is also good in the plan of God. So all metaphysical healing, I would say, does not conform really to this place value. That all the metaphysical groups all over the world, all the demonstrations that are made in positive thinking and all the whatever those groups are, that always try to demonstrate something that is pleasant to them, that seems to be a fulfillment to them, is certainly built on the wrong basis.
Is this where we wait patiently for divine love to move upon the waters of mortality?
Exactly, yeah. That's a very good point, yeah? That's it, huh? Yeah. Where we wait patiently for divine love to move upon the mortal concept, to form the perfect concept. Yes. Yeah, perfect concept mind, perfect love. But then it was love that moved it, yes, and not our desire. When we come to the last box, the principle, what did we see here? It always sums up very easily here. Principle stands alone, so to say, takes together the divinely objective and divinely subjective in one go and says what? It's the omni-action we had here, then in the box we can perhaps put that omni-action into other terms. Say, all that is going on is the idea of principle. All that there is going on is actually the idea of principle. You perhaps just write that down. All that there is going on, the idea of principle. Here you see very nicely the divinely objective sense, namely all that there is going on, we can see the objectification of that principle working, and then we say, now, what is it really? Is it really a divinely objective thing? No, It's more than that. Behind the divinely objective almost must stand a divinely subjective origin and standpoint, and that's principle again. So the idea of principle at work is the divinely objective. Principle itself working this idea is the divinely subjective, and there you have it, very close together. So that you feel all that there is going on is actually the divinely objective, subjective sense of being. Yes. Well, that would bring us really to the next column. Now, what is the next column? Well, it's the divinely subjective objective. Now, what does it mean? It means another standpoint. It means now that we look out from God. In the first column, we were looking at God's objectification. In the first column, see, we said, in the very first, can you see the first one? We said, what are the ideas of God? We don't know what the ideas of God are. All right, then we go and try to find out what the ideas of God are. Where can I find it out? There is somewhere a textbook where they are laid out. All right, I approach now that textbook as if there would be the answer to this question, and so I look at them as an objective sense. I take these ideas without first having at all a divinely subjective sense about them. I take them as if they would object, as if they would be, a chair and a table and a cupboard and I don't know what they are there, and then say, now what do they mean? And only when I begin to ask, what does it mean, I make them divinely subjective. So here we take another view. We take the view from God, the divinely subjective standpoint, and try to see what such a divinely subjective standpoint objectifies, which divine object it uses in this science order. Therefore, we take again those synonymous terms, but look at them from always from the second synonymous term, from that which is on the right-hand side, namely from life, and then from truth, and then from love. Because you know, in the candlestick, naturally, life, truth, and love show the subjective sense of that principle, whereas mind, spirit, soul shows the objective sense of the principle, the nature of principle. So if we look at that candlestick, you see, from the right to the left, we have a different standpoint. And this is necessary because it reveals to us some kind of a method of understanding and demonstration. So let's see first the word again. Here now it would be life and soul, not soul and life, if we take that standpoint. And what do we find here in a science? We still are in a science, in a being sense. What do we find in a science if we look out from life and objectify that as soul? What does that really mean?
Being is identified.
You could say that being, life, that being is identified, soul, or you can say that being always identifies itself, and then you could say, as numerals of infinity or so, through what divinely objective sense does being identify itself? We can ask further. But you say, well, it needs a divinely objective tool to identify itself. And I think here you have something what you know very easily, very well.
Unchangeable self identity.
Yes.
Every idea of being has an unchangeable self identity.
You said that that every idea of being has an unchangeable identity.
Unchangeable and safe identity.
And safe identity. Yes. Is that a science standpoint at this point? Or shouldn't we much more see that being does identify itself as unchangeable sanctity. Is it true? Through something objective. Through rules, perhaps. Through spiritual understanding. Through spiritual sense. Huh? Can you see? You can see it very clearly if I explain it properly. To explain properly means to change the approach always more and more. Let's say you are absolute neophyte in Christian Science. And so you say, somebody says, you know, but there is a science of being. I said, oh yes, Now what does it consist of? The moment I ask, what does it consist of? I have the first column, the objective sense of it. Said, okay, you know, it consists of identities of being, of identities that are, that soul and life. Then he says, oh, that's interesting. How on earth am I aware of them? And he said, oh, well, you know, that's another proposition. You know, you can only be aware of them if you understand them spiritually. Otherwise, you can't. So you have to know that being is only being understood through your spiritual understanding or through spiritual sense. Then you have it. Else you don't have it. You see, that life, being, identifies itself, but through what? Through something that is of the nature of spiritual understanding, spiritual sense, soul sense, that identifies your being. That's how being objectifies itself. In other terms, I put it now the other way around, even simpler, say, well, everybody that whom you would ask, what is this Christian Science and so on, would say, you know, it has to do with being, but you have to understand it spiritually. It is, you know what is, that it is, that's unchangeable, that being is unchangeable, that is it. Huh? But you have to understand it through a channel, which is objective. You have to understand it through a channel of spiritual sense, spiritual understanding, through soul sense, then it becomes identified to you. So here we get another aspect than just to say, as in the first column, the identities, the unchangeable identities are what they are. They are unchangeable identities of being, but divinely subjective, we should understand them. So being has to be spiritually understood, life and soul. Wouldn't everybody say that to anybody? Say, well, being has to be understood through spiritual sense. So you have, I guess here, life and soul, and we can perhaps put here that being must be understood or can only be understood, that being can only be identified through spiritual understanding. That being can only be identified, objectified through spiritual understanding. There you can put in brackets soul sense, spiritual sense, or whatever goes into that category. Yes? So we come to the next one, to the calculus from a subjective standpoint. We go out from truth and look at spirit. Now, what is that truth doing with those identities of being, with those ideas? What is truth doing in order to bring out new reflections? That's now the other way around, huh? Yeah?
Conscious. Truth. Knowing. Being conscious.
That's truth. And spirit?
Of the calculus.
Truth conscious of its calculus. Mm-hmm. That's perhaps why we have calculus in the textbook as the calculus of spirit and the calculus of truth. Both ways she speaks about the calculus, yes. But what does it mean that truth is conscious of its calculus?
It objectifies its own consciousness in a calculation.
Yeah, all right. Oh, good. Truth objectifies its own truth consciousness or its Christ consciousness in a calculus. For objectification. How does that objectification takes place in spirit?
Through the ordering.
I think
ability.
So. Huh? The ordering ability. Now here, can you see? it's from the subjective standpoint that says, how on earth does a calculus really bring out a true calculation? Can you see? It's now asking that. And therefore we see that from a divinely subjective standpoint, the truth consciousness says, I have within me all ideas, because I rely on the word of the identity of being. I have all ideas within myself. But what I'm going to do, divinely subjective, is all that ideas. I am going to order them. I'm going to blend them. I do that. So that you have really here the fact-arranging activity of science. Like Bronowski defined science. Here you have that. It's no more just the fact-knowing activity or the fact-finding activity or the fact-knowing activity, but much more now we have here spirit as the fact-arranging, the fact-ordering activity, the fact-hierarchy ordering ideas, just putting all ideas into the right categories. That's why a calculus can go on. So here she speaks, gives us the sense, an explanation that in that black box again, there is that infinite, reservoir of facts that are known to truth, and now truth takes them subjectively, divinely subjectively, and says, I'm aware of them and I objectify myself. How? By ordering these ideas at the way I want to order them. I'm the ordering authority in being. And again, you get a very divinely subjective sense that you say, I can't order things. I can't play God. I can't play the Christ. I have to let truth, consciousness as the Christ, order everything in my life, order everything in my family, ordering everything in my business, ordering everything in my country, ordering everything in the world. Truth knows how to operate, how to order. It's therefore the fact-ordering activity. So what could we put here? We could perhaps say truth is a fact-ordering activity. Yes? So sometimes I ask myself very much, you see, if it would not be even better to have these two categories changed, to start out first with the divinely subjective objective, that is to look at the candlestick from the right to the left. How is it? Didn't the Hebrew write from right to left? Huh? I think they had another aspect, and we all always try to see everything from the left to the right. And in a way, it feels much more sensible, really, to have a view of that candlestick from the right to the left. Perhaps we'll discuss that after our break.